This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we turn our attention to the South Caucasus, where a conflict between majority Christian Armenia and majority Muslim Azerbaijan over the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh may be in danger of erupting into all-out war. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Nagorno-Karabakh is a landlocked, primarily ethnic Armenian region in Azerbaijan, which is located in the Caucasus, a strategically important mountainous region in Southeast Europe. Multiple historical sources say that for centuries, Muslim and Christian powers in the region have vied for control there. According to the BBC website, modern-day Armenia and Azerbaijan both became part of the Soviet Union when it was formed in the 1920s. Even though Nagorno-Karabakh was an ethnic majority Armenian region, the Soviets gave control over the area to Azerbaijan authorities. The BBC goes on to say that, quote, as the Soviet Union saw increasing tensions in its constituent republics in the 1980s, Nagorno-Karabakh voted to become part of Armenia, sparking a war which stopped with a Russian-brokered ceasefire in 1994. Since then, Nagorno-Karabakh remained part of Azerbaijan, but is controlled by separatist ethnic Armenians backed by the Armenian government, close quote. The 1994 ceasefire had basically held for 22 years, despite periodic violations, but clearly the underlying ethno-religious and geopolitical tensions percolated just beneath the surface. It is unclear who provoked the latest round of fighting, which erupted in late September. However, the current death toll stands at more than 300, which includes civilians. And this round of conflict features artillery shelling and the deployment of heavy weapons and vehicles, further undermining regional stability and threatening to draw in major powers like Russia, Turkey, and Iran. Turkey has close ties with Azerbaijan, and Russia is allied with Armenia, where it maintains a military base, thereby placing Turkey and Russia on opposite sides of yet another conflict. Ankara and Moscow are also competing for influence in Syria and Libya. From a geopolitical perspective, the Sufan Center reminds us in a recent Intel Brief newsletter that, quote, the South Caucasus is a critical area for oil and natural gas pipelines, carrying energy resources from the Caspian Sea to global markets. Azerbaijan has benefited from its access to energy, using proceeds to build a technologically advanced arsenal of weapons, close quote. Since 1992, the so-called Minsk Group, comprising the United States, Russia, and France, has been responsible for helping the conflicting parties move toward an agreement. However, their recent calls for an immediate ceasefire in Nagorno-Karabakh have yielded little progress. Well, for more on the reasons behind and ramifications of renewed fighting over Nagorno-Karabakh, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh is a 22-year career U.S. diplomat with extensive experience in conflict resolution, arms control, and humanitarian issues. Under the administrations of Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, Ambassador Kavanaugh advanced peace efforts involving Armenia, Cyprus, Georgia, Greece, Moldova, Tajikistan, and Turkey. He's currently professor of diplomacy at the University of Kentucky. And Jonathan Katz. He's director of democracy initiatives and a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, based in Washington. And prior to joining GMF, Jonathan served as the deputy assistant administrator in the Europe and Eurasia Bureau at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams as we continue to social distance. Welcome to the program. And let me turn to you for just that, Ambassador Kavanaugh. Why is the outbreak of violence in Nagorno-Karabakh disconcerting and really dangerous, not just for Armenians and Azeris, but for the wider region and even the world?
Well, I think your sort of introduction laid out many of the key factors. This is a historic region where empires came together, the Persian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire. And as it's transitioned to modern time, it's always been a source of who has influence here and what can be done. So that's a piece of it. And more relevant is it reflects problems we've seen in other corners of the world, where with the collapse of some nation states, the end of colonialism, you have questions about territorial integrity and sovereignty. You have issues about national self-determination. And what this conflict represents is a struggle for that and a division over that. And in the international sphere, both of those things are viewed as accepted principles. The United Nations and the Helsinki Final Act both enshrine the importance of territorial integrity and sovereignty, but also the recognition that ethnic groups, nations, have some key rights to self-determination. And what we see is those are playing out here. You noted in the introduction that one side is Christian and one side is Muslim. And it's important to say here that that hasn't been a principal factor of this conflict. Azerbaijan, under Soviet rule, very secular society. And what we see here isn't so much a religious fight or a Huntington-like class of civilizations, but much more this issue of where do you get to live? Do you live with people of the same ethnicity, or do you live in a neighboring state controlled by a majority of people of a different ethnicity? The location means Russia will always be a potential player in here. Turkey will always have concerns. Iran will always be watchful. And because of the energy reserves in this region, the United States played a key role in its development following the collapse of the Soviet Union, working on the promotion of democracy and very significant projects to build the economic potential of the region and to craft gas and oil pipelines that would not go through Russia, but would allow this region the option to export their energy resources directly to the European market.
Thank you for that, Mr. Ambassador. Let me now turn to Jonathan Katz for your take, Jonathan. Anything to add or subtract, and why has this conflict simmered for so long without concrete resolution?
Well, I agree with everything that Ambassador Kavanaugh said. And, you know, he pointed to sort of the number of the topics that you raise at the top of this, why this is potentially explosive. One, we see the type of fighting between the two sides that hasn't been seen in quite some time. There was escalation signs that occurred earlier in the year, in the summer. There's a lack of international attention right now based on a number of different factors. So you're not having the type of mediation that you might see typically when we had the July flare-up. You have COVID, you have a United States that's very distracted right now internally with an upcoming election. But I really think an administration that hasn't shown a great deal of interest in this particular conflict. It's not a cold conflict. It's been hot and ongoing for quite some time, despite the fact that there's been an OSCE process that Ambassador Kavanaugh knows directly about and has been involved in. And so when you have these different powers, and I think one of the X factors for me really is Turkey and sort of this increased role that Turkey is playing. And I really think this is a real buildup of President Erdogan's engagement in these types of military conflicts, whether it's in Syria or Libya, that he has been increasing Turkish military engagement. He's particularly unpopular at home economically in response to COVID-19. And one of the ways that he has sought to bolster his own power internally to address some of these challenges is through the use of military expeditions like we're seeing. And so to me, it's a bit different than we've seen in the past in terms of the escalation of the Turkish role. But Ambassador Kavanaugh is right. Turkey and Azerbaijan have had strong relations for quite some time. The pipelines that we talk about from Azerbaijan go through Turkey and also through Georgia. Russia has a military base in Armenia. That's not new. And also Armenia is part of the Eurasia Economic Union and has a security arrangements with Russia as well. And Iran has always been a neighbor that has had challenges, particularly with Azerbaijan and its own ethnic Azeri populations and concerns about that population. So you have multiple factors, but a very distracted United States. I'm hopeful that, you know, when there are discussions in Geneva, and then in a few days after that, they'll take place in Moscow within a certain period. Hopefully, the call for a unconditional ceasefire is something that can happen. I'm not convinced right now, particularly that certain sides believe it's in their favor right now to end this current round of fighting. But I'm hopeful with greater international attention through the Minsk process, again, that we can get these two parties to stand down, because we all recall back in 88 to 94, the devastation that took place, tens of thousands killed, millions displaced. This is an incredibly serious situation. And when we talk about hundreds killed or injured already, and the possibility of this escalating, the international community in the U.S. really need to be as involved as possible to prevent this from getting worse.
Carol, could I pick up on a point Jonathan made that I think is very important to highlight here? And that's this changed position of Turkey. In the past, when these skirmishes or border clashes would break out, they would be quickly stopped with calls for diplomatic action, restore the ceasefire, come back to the negotiating table. And with this clash, the one that started just days ago, we saw the same international chorus from the United Nations to the United States, Russia, France, the major European countries, all saying, stop, restore the ceasefire, go back to the negotiating table. But what was different here is the message from Ankara has been, don't stop. It's been, in fact, an encouragement of, no, you need to take your land back. Armenia is the problem. Armenia needs to give it back, and they've been the threat to stability in this region. Normally, I think that wouldn't have gone very far. But as Jonathan said, the big powers have been distracted. He noted the United States, but I would also add Russia and Putin himself, very concerned about developments in Belarus, in Kyrgyzstan, the situation in Ukraine. There's a lot of issues going on for President Putin that makes it much more difficult to engage in a way they have in the past. And we've seen Turkey has not been reluctant to come up against Russian forces. It's done that in Syria. It's done that in Libya. So the thought that that would deter them from being more supportive of aggression here, that seems to have faded, if not disappeared.
Let me clarify something with you, Jonathan. Now, Nagorno-Karabakh, it's under Azerbaijan jurisdiction, is it not? But it's Armenian controlled. Just explain the situation.
I think you mentioned earlier that, I mean, this was a product of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And so what you mentioned at the beginning was that the territory in dispute, Nagorno-Karabakh, is largely populated by Armenians, but the territory itself is part of Azerbaijan. So I think Ambassador Kavanaugh mentioned too this scenario where you have a majority population that would like to be either independent or part of another country where it believes it would be best represented. And so the dispute right now is over this territory. There's no international recognition of Nagorno-Karabakh as an independent nation. And again, when we start to look at the OSCE process, you have really fairly clear principles called the Madrid principles that were established to try to resolve what is an asset. Since this dispute, one is return of certain territories, because when fighting broke out, not only was this particular part of Nagorno-Karabakh occupied or controlled by Armenia, but you had territories outside of this area as well, also Azeri territory. And that's where you had a lot of displaced persons also being forced out. So when we're talking about this conflict itself, we're also talking about these other territories. And part of the discussion or solution is that quite possibly one of the aims of Baku in this current conflict is maybe not a complete resolution of the Nagorno-Karabakh land itself, but these other territories that surround Nagorno-Karabakh. And that would mean a return of some of that area as being seen as success in Baku or a step in sort of resolving this issue. So you have more than just one piece of territory, but you also have, Ambassador also sort of alluded to it, an historic claim as well to this land, and also a byproduct of the breakup of the Soviet Union and sort of how territory that time was partitioned. And when you had these independent countries popping up post-Soviet breakup, you had the situation where you have this majority population ending up in Azerbaijan territory, and then you had Armenia as an independent country and a clear connection to Armenia. So you have this dispute. And okay. I think it's not unlike we've seen in other places around the globe where you have these disputes. So it's a complicated history. The resolution requires both sides to find ways to move forward on issues that they feel so strongly about, and that they have to be ready to make these compromises that have not been able to meet over the last 2.5 decades of negotiation, something the ambassador was part of in sort of the initial stages after 1994. But I think it's not impossible. The parameters of how this could work out are there. It's a matter of the will of both Baku and Yerevan to come to the table to agree to move forward.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh, former U.S. diplomat, now professor of diplomacy at the University of Kentucky, and Jonathan Katz, from whom you just heard. He's director of Democracy Initiatives and senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund. That's a think tank here in Washington. And they join me via Microsoft Teams as we examine the broader strategic implications of the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh in the South Caucasus. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Paul Ngonga from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program and back to you, Ambassador Kavanaugh. Here's a question for you. Is it fair to say that Azerbaijan and Armenia could potentially work this out if it weren't maybe for the instigation of Turkey and other powers?
It's actually fair to say they've always had the potential to work it out. What's been difficult is taking the hard political steps to do it. People often have asked, is peace here impossible? No. In the negotiating framework that was established by OSCE, where the United States, France, and Russia share leadership for this mediation, several times they've actually weighed approaches that had promised for achieving peace. The dilemma, as Jonathan said earlier, is they've not on either side really been fully ready to offer the compromises required to make that happen. Part of the problem has been this kind of fighting. Right. Populations have a hard time agreeing to peace if you've just had a bloody clash. And part of the problem has been leaders have not worked very hard to prepare their populations to accept a compromise solution. They'll give very maximalist positions in their public statements. We will get all our land back. We will be victorious, or we will always protect our people. You don't have to worry. But then in private, they're willing to talk about, well, what if we did this?
I see.
How about that? We could do right. this if you do that. So there can be a solution.
Right. So let me turn to you, Jonathan. Assuming that Yerevan and Baku could come to some kind of a compromise, what would the outlines look like? How would it be different from today?
I think the first thing that the international community is asking them to do is to have a ceasefire, unconditional ceasefire. And that means that they're going to have to sit down with both Baku and with Yerevan to try to get to that point where both sides will stop fighting. Because I think until that happens, trying to get back to negotiating table is going to be quite difficult. That means urging Erdogan and Ankara to pull back to see a much more constructive approach by Ankara would be important in this process. But then I mentioned earlier these Madrid principles that lay out, you know, 6 steps for settlement. Ambassador, you may have been involved in this, which is returning the territories surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijani control. Interim status for Nagorno-Karabakh, providing guarantees for security and governance, you know, corridor that links Armenia to Nagorno-Karabakh. And then we have to talk about internally displaced persons and their ability to return to where they formerly lived, and international security guarantees, including potentially that of a peacekeeping operation. So those are the 6 elements of Madrid. And obviously, you know, there's areas of those principles where either side can find fault and not want to carry out those 6 elements. And then the timetable of how you do that and, you know, what comes first, the devil is in the details of that. But this isn't new. This has been on the table. You know, these principles, these ideas have been on the table even before the Madrid principles were sort of enshrined. So I think if we can look at a potential future outcome, it would look like this. Because frankly, this region, both countries, in the end, really need to have security and peace. We want to see that both from the United States and the international community. I can't say that all actors, including those that are part of the Minsk group, actually want to see complete resolution of this issue. You know, Moscow, which often uses these hot, or some people call them cold, conflicts that haven't been resolved to achieve their political objectives. But if we all sat down and wanted to see a resolution that ensured stability, security, and economic future for the South Caucasus in these 2 countries, the Madrid principles are one way that could help lead both sides of the process. But if there's no political will to do this, then you're not going to achieve these objectives. And let's be very clear, on one side of Baku, you've had President Aliyev, who's a longstanding sort of authoritarian figure in Azerbaijan, Mr. Pashinyan, who came in, what was the Velvet Revolution, semi-democratic country. there's two different competing political systems, big powers sort of playing roles at sort of trying to control their own interests. And so you said earlier, you know, outside powers do play a role, but the two powers that are together in this process, which is the two countries that are in conflict right now, really set the tone for what they want. I don't see necessarily the political will on the other side to fulfill what's laid out in the Madrid principles.
Mm-hmm. I have to give you the last word, Ambassador Kavanaugh, because you wrote in a paper recently that you think that maybe the situation warrants naming a UN special representative, that the Minsk group isn't enough. Talk about ultimately how this can be resolved and the impediments. Is Moscow as great an obstacle or is Ankara, or is Ankara the real barrier here or the actor that's interfering in preventing a resolution? How do you see this playing out?
As I said earlier, Ankara's role of late, and it's due, is as a cheerleader. Russia's role has not actually been that bad in this region. I think Russia has recognized they couldn't bring about peace here on their own. They needed to do it in conjunction with others, and that's why they joined forces with OSCE in the 90s to work on this. And the cooperation in that mediation format has actually been kind of amazing. There's not been much light between the United States, Russia, and France on how you move this forward. The challenge is the complexity, as Jonathan pointed out. And I'd add, when I worked on negotiations here, I used to compare notes with Dennis Ross. Dennis Ross was our longtime Middle East peace negotiator. And Dennis would always remark, every issue we were dealing with as regards the Israelis and the Palestinians was replicated in Nagorno-Karabakh. So it should be understood it's hard to resolve. The other piece that's different now is they're dying. This is a tragic conflict that broke out. The death toll is unknown. The Nagorno-Karabakh authorities have released concrete numbers of how many civilians killed, how many of their military force has been killed. There are no military losses reported from Azerbaijan, unimaginable in the amount of fighting that's taken place. And we see the spillover in recent days that more fighting is taking place further from the line of contact, which means more of it is entailing attacks that bring danger to civilian populations. It has already been reported that upwards of 90% of the women and children in the Nagorno-Karabakh region have been displaced because of the fighting. That's a problem. The attacks in cities and villages in Azerbaijan along the line of contact has also had movement of civilian populations. And as Jonathan said, until you can stop that fighting, it's impossible to bring them to the negotiating table. My comment on the UN has not been that the UN should be replacing this OSCE mediation mechanism. I think what the UN could do through the Secretary General's good offices is bring yet another perspective in. It would show greater international attention. And we know both parties have claimed there's not been enough international attention. And it's understood that the fighting has continued, that UN agencies and UN itself is going to be called to task to help with this. It will be the UN that provides humanitarian relief. When you see the UN come, you know that means there's a lot of problems going on. And these are leaders and these are their people. They may want to gain ground politically, but they certainly don't want to see widespread death and destruction in their countries.
Indeed, gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but I want to thank you both for bringing important facts to bear with regard to this very critical problem in Nagorno-Karabakh. For now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh, former career diplomat, currently professor of diplomacy at the University of Kentucky, and Jonathan Katz, director of democracy initiatives and senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund. Gentlemen, once again, thanks for your spot on and terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.